the field in the manner of any of the Axis leaders, or perhaps even his own allies, Churchill and Stalin. He outsourced most of the key operational decisions to his senior advisers, who crafted the first Joint Chiefs of Staff, Generals Arnold and Marshall, and Admirals King and Leahy. The four, nominally equally representative of air, land, and sea power under the auspices of Leahy, mostly on their own, made such decisions about which generals were appointed, transferred, or fired, with notable exceptions such as Roosevelt's decision to save and keep manageable the politically connected General MacArthur as Supreme Pacific Commander, and thus out of domestic politics, or quite unfairly to have fired the prescient Admiral James O. Richardson, expert on the Japanese Navy, who had warned about moving the unprepared Pacific Fleet to an exposed Pearl Harbor berth. Such delegation was largely more successful than the alternative practiced by both the Axis and other allies, and usually led to the selection of superb field commanders. When it did not, a holdover showboat commander like Lieutenant General Lloyd Fridenhall, or an incompetent Major General John Lucas, the lapse did not reflect on Roosevelt's leadership. More interestingly, Roosevelt delighted in audacious commanders whose temperament and language could hardly be termed liberal. He made the necessary allowances for the talented but crusty Chief of Naval Operations Ernest King and kept him on after retirement age. Indirectly supported the retention of George S. Patton after the infamous slapping incidents, and liked to hear of the aggressiveness and even occasional recklessness of admirals like Bill Halsey. A more hands-on commander-in-chief, appointing and firing generals as Lincoln did in managing Union strategy in the Civil War, might have raised greater skepticism about the costs versus benefits of early daylight and unescorted strategic bombing. He could have cross-examined the conduct of the Italian campaign, the Arnhem effort, or the preliminary plans to invade Okinawa. Yet Roosevelt's strength was his early intuition that Europe's early border wars between September 1939 and May 1941 presaged an existential struggle between democracy and an evil European fascism of a sort not seen before. Even in the mid-1930s, he rightly assumed that compromise with Hitler was impossible, something universally obvious in hindsight, but not so clear to most of Roosevelt's European and American contemporaries other than the realist Winston Churchill. Perhaps the president's tragic lapse was that he did not bring the same degree of deep distrust to an equally murderous Soviet totalitarianism. In its post-war planning, the United States sometimes went well beyond the realpolitik of encouraging and enabling Soviet resistance to the Wehrmacht, to a naive belief that Uncle Joe was a reasonable man and his style of Soviet communism a mere rough sort of socialism that might become a possible future compliant partner of the British and American democracies. Had Roosevelt been as suspicious of Stalin's murderous gulag and expansionary plans as he was sometimes of Churchill's effort to preserve Britain's colonial possessions, the United States might have been better prepared for the Cold War that was already beginning by 1944. It is hard to know the extent to which Roosevelt's naivete imperiled the alliance or led to the foundations of the Cold War, but there is no doubt that he was not only naive but vain about what he thought was his ability to manipulate an even wilier Stalin. He once inanely lectured Churchill in early 1942, "I know you will not mind me being brutally frank when I tell you that I think I can personally handle Stalin better than either your Foreign Office or my State Department. Stalin hates the guts of all your top people. He thinks he likes me better, and I hope he will continue to do so." The bottom line for FDR as a wartime leader is unambiguous. Under him, American planners charted out two spheres of responsibility against Japan. The Pacific Islands and their trajectories to Tokyo would be the focus of the United States, while Burma and the Indian Ocean area would be the greater colonial concerns of Britain. If the two allies would seek parallel paths to defeating Japan, in Europe their planning would be nearly uniform. Roosevelt assured the jittery British that they would no longer face Hitler alone, while in the Pacific, America would seek its own pathways toward Tokyo and not quibble with the British over their imperial interests, but on occasion supply them ample troops and air power to fight in Burma. If Roosevelt lacked the street-fighting ability and experience of the lower-class Hitler, Mussolini, and Stalin, he nonetheless knew what it was to suffer physically. He was politically ruthless without being immoral, amid a cataclysmic war in which both his enemies and his ally Joseph Stalin were politically ruthless and homicidal. When America's numerous wartime strategic, economic, and operational successes are weighed against its much rarer lapses, Franklin Delano Roosevelt deserves great credit as a force multiplier of American industry and its 12 million man armed forces. If a wartime leader is to be judged solely on the amoral basis of promoting his country's short-term national interests, such as surviving a surprise attack of 4 million Axis troops, Joseph Stalin stands above all the rest. For the first 3 years of World War II, 1939 through 1942, however, Stalin was often the stereotypical paranoid, parochial, and bloodthirsty communist apparatchik. Although Stalin had tripled the size of the Red Army in just the 4 years between 1937 and 1941, it was shorted over 60,000 high-ranking officers, given his savage purges of 1937 through 1939 that sent some of his best commanders to the firing squad and mostly exiled the rest. The newly enrolled 400,000 officers of the Red Army that first met the Germans in June 1941 were, for the most part, without much more than 2 years' experience. Stalin had also foolishly pushed the Molotov-Ribbentrop non-aggression pact, apparently clueless that Hitler would break it at his convenience. His idea that capitalist states would exhaust themselves in endless wars in Western Europe to the benefit of the Soviet Union displayed a deep misunderstanding of the strength of the Royal Navy and Royal Air Force, and of the central message of Mein Kampf, best summed up by Hitler's adage that German victory was incompatible with Russian ideology. Stalin's effort to annex slices of southern Finland almost ended in disaster. He was criminally negligent in ignoring intelligence warnings about the impending Operation Barbarossa, again failing to grasp that Hitler's destructive ideology was ultimately pointed eastward. He seemed to have experienced some sort of incapacity for the first 2 weeks of the German invasion and did not appear to the public until July 3, 1941. For the first 3 months of the German invasion, his no-retreat orders doomed over 2 million Russians, who were taken prisoner in huge encirclements and, for the most part, never accounted for. After stunning defensive successes at Moscow in December 1941 and Stalingrad in February 1943, Stalin ordered precipitous counteroffensives that often proved near catastrophic. Stalin's self-interested duplicities needlessly ensured a falling out with his own allies before the war's conclusion. His shrill and disingenuous demands for a second front ignored the fact that the Soviet Union had been Hitler's de facto ally and that there existed a second front of British expeditionary forces trying to help France in 1940 and when Germany bombed a lonely Britain months later. Unlike Britain, Stalin had only joined the anti-fascist side of the war when his fascist partner double-crossed him. Stalin envisioned the Allied alliance as a war only against the invaders of the Soviet Union and delegated effort against Italy and the Japanese to the British and Americans. It is impossible to underestimate Stalin's ingratitude. He was an amnesiac to the fact that the new Soviet Union, under the terms of the March 1918 Brest-Litovsk Treaty with victorious Imperial Germany, had lost nearly a quarter of its territory and won much of it back nearly 9 months later due only to the Western Allies' victory and insistence at Versailles that German-occupied territory be restored to its owners. Stalin gave little credit to the Allied effort in North Africa, Sicily, and Italy, the strategic bombing of the Third Reich, the Anglo-American War against the Japanese, Lend-Lease, and the naval war against the Axis, all of which predated the Second Front that opened on June 6, 1944. Stalin's pouts and accusations were serial, and he often begged off conferences with his two Allied partners. Because Stalin had occasionally dreamed of and concluded various separate accommodations with Hitler, he was inevitably accusing Churchill and Roosevelt of just such duplicity. The irony of his rule was that his own responsibility for the deaths of millions of Russians in the collectivizations and purges of the 1920s and 1930s had hardened him psychologically for the mass death visited upon his people by the Wehrmacht. No wonder the murderous Hitler admired him most of the Allied Big Three. Stalin was of little or no direct help to the Allied European and Pacific strategic bombing campaigns. He made it almost impossible to continue fueling Allied bombers on turnaround stops in the Ukraine and interned B-29 crews downed in Soviet territory. Ostensibly, Stalin triangulated out of fears of breaking accords with the Japanese and thus losing his safe transit lines of lend-lease material across the Pacific from the American West Coast, and, more pragmatically, hoped to gain an edge in the post-war era, such as by reverse engineering detained B-29s. He ensured that the Russian people did not know the full extent of British and American help to Russia and their contributions to winning the war. The Soviet massacre of over 20,000 Polish officers in the Katyn Forest was Hitlerian, so was Stalin's contrived delay before Warsaw to allow the Wehrmacht to kill off his future Polish anti-communist rivals. His vision of a post-war communist Eastern Europe often trumped strategies for defeating the Wehrmacht in 1944 and 1945. All that said, it is hard to imagine any other wartime leader, with the possible exception of Churchill, who could have lost nearly 20-30% of his territory to enemy occupation, much of his industrial production, with over a quarter of his population destroyed or occupied, and yet in little over a year so reorganized his vastly reduced nation that it outproduced Nazi Germany in critical areas like tanks and planes. The wholesale transfer of Soviet industry far to the east of Moscow still staggers the imagination. So do the harsh conditions under which Soviet workers vastly outproduced their pan-European counterparts, a continuation of the increase in Soviet war production centered in the Urals that was already underway in the late 1930s. When the Third Reich peaked and then ebbed in early 1943, there was no possibility of recovery analogous to the Russian rebound after the disasters of 1941 and 1942. Stalin's tenacity convinced even some of the German general staff that the loss of European Russia and the chief cities of the Soviet Union would not de facto mean the end of the Soviet ability to wage war. More mysterious, the Soviet command economy produced not only vast amounts of munitions and weaponry, but also high-quality tanks, artillery, rockets, and fighter bombers. Capitalism encouraged individual genius to produce unmatched technology in a way impossible in authoritarian societies and command economies. But during World War II, Stalin's Russia had so borrowed, stolen, or invented new weapons and processes of industrial production that its later armies were often the best equipped of the war. At war's end in September 1945, Churchill had been humiliated by being voted out of office. Roosevelt, Hitler, and Mussolini were dead. Tojo discredited, bereft of supreme power, and fated to meet the gallows. In contrast to them all, the old dictator Stalin, perhaps the greatest mass murderer in recorded history, was thriving and would live on another 8 years to threaten the two allies that had helped save him. The Soviets would carve out a buffer zone in Eastern Europe before occupying its share of conquered Germany. Stalin rightly figured that the Allies would value the Russian destruction of the German army far more than they would worry about his own past genocides, his opportunistic armistice with Japan, or his apparent unwillingness to abide by promises of free elections in lands that the Red Army occupied. If Stalin's strategy was by needs one-dimensional, it also proved apt, relying on Allied material aid, various second fronts opening in the West, and an exclusive Anglo-American effort against the Japanese. Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin were sophisticated strategic thinkers who knew why they went to war, where to fight it, and how to end it. In contrast, Hitler, Mussolini, and Tojo started wars without a realistic appreciation of the resources of their enemies, or of how they might impair the Allied ability to produce material and raise manpower, much less of how they were to close out such theaters to their own advantage. Basic questions of ensuring ample means for vaulted strategic ends were ignored by an Axis command blinded by ideology and impatient with the details of what it took to create effective militaries to fight on a global scale. Given Axis material inferiority on land, at sea, and in the air, Allied leaders needed only to be competent rather than inspired. that most Allied leaders, and as discussed in the next chapter, generals and admirals as well, proved as good as or better than their German, Italian, and Japanese counterparts, meant that a war largely predetermined by production and manpower could be won even more rapidly by skill and insight. 17. The Warlords. Classical authors offer instructive biographies of foolish and wise generals, such as the portraits of Nicias, Germanicus, and Pompey found in Thucydides, Tacitus, and Plutarch. How to-do guides give point-by-point advice on organization, deployment, logistics, tactics, and strategy, especially the handbooks of Xenophon, Onosander, Aeneas Tacitus, Vegetius, and Maurice, and later interpolated by Machiavelli, Valturius, and other Renaissance humanists. In this vast corpus of received military thought, common themes emerge. The commander in the field should be young, preferably under 50, if not 45. J.F.C. Fuller once listed those he thought were the 100 greatest generals from antiquity through World War I to prove that the best were under 40. Fuller made his point, but also failed to note that an advocate of experience and maturity might equally have made up a comparable list of winners who scored impressive victories in their 50s and 60s, including stars whom Fuller ignored, such as the Hellenistic general Antigonus Monophthalmus, the Spartan king Agesilaus, Justinian's right-hand fireman generals Belisarius and Narses, the German duo of Hindenburg and Ludendorff, the British colonial fighter Frederick Roberts, or the Athenian strategist Pericles. In sum, generalship is more like any other profession in which the advantages of youthful vigor clash with mature experience. In the context of World War II, Patton ended the war at 60 years of age, Nimitz was 59 in 1945, MacArthur 65, suggesting that in most cases 35-year-olds are still too green and most over 70 too tired. Whatever his exalted station, the proverbial general also should have some first-hand experience of the front lines, and so be seen by his men in action. Supposed chateau generalship at the head of armies during World War I was widely criticized both during and after the war as a bureaucratic rejection of wise military counsel of some 2,500 years that it was important to be seen with the army in battle. George Marshall's mythical Little Black Book contained the names of dozens of vigorous colonels and youngish lieutenant colonels, whom Marshall, himself 60 at the time of Pearl Harbor, considered would be likely future generals in any upcoming war and a better investment than their peacetime senior officers. Health mattered, both physical energy and robustness of mind. Perhaps vigor proved more advantageous than even experience and sobriety, thus again Marshall's pre-war preference for youth over age. Yet by World War II, at the dawn of the revolution in health and medicine, being 50 or 55 perhaps was not quite the same as it had been in 1814, especially given that generals, rather than riding or walking at the head of their armies, were driven and ate food and drank water, less likely to sicken them. Past combat experience was almost essential. So was formal military education, not just in tactical arrangement, but also in strategic and operational arts learned by the study of history and memoirs of the great captains of the past. Individualism, even idiosyncrasy, was prized more than caricatured. Showiness in dress, appearance, as well as comportment and eccentricity in speech and behavior. The great general needed to prove why he was one with, but also different from, his men. For Alexander, it was his trademark ram horn helmet. For Pompey, a blue rather than the more normal red cloak. For Patton, his twin ivory-handled revolvers. For MacArthur, his contrived corncob pipe and aviator sunglasses. For Ridgway in Korea, a grenade and first aid kit plastered on his chest, old iron tits. Grant and Sherman drew attention by appearing almost shabbier than their men, which, by the bleak summer of 1864, might have had the same effect in boosting morale as did George B. McClellan's earlier occasional ostentatiousness. These were only ideals and allowed latitude for notable exceptions, such as General Gebhard von Blücher, who saved Waterloo when 72. General Dwight D. Eisenhower appeared a consummate bureaucrat and undistinguished in uniform, never speaking with much panache or turn of phrase. Omar Bradley or Courtney Hodges in uniform appeared naturally commonplace rather than commonplace by volition. Neither was an orator nor a great captain. The architects of earlier German victories in World War II, such as Generals von Bock, von Lieb, von Rundstedt, and Manstein, looked like ordinary bureaucrats. Generalship was sometimes not as important as supreme command, manpower, logistics, or equipment. At least there was also an understanding that in modern industrial war, the general could not overcome the impossible. The North African battlefield that faced the dashing Rommel in 1942 was different from the one in Normandy of 1944 that seemed to overwhelm the often tired and sick veteran general. It was easier for Manstein to shine in 1940 than in 1943. Bradley had a less demanding task as an army commander in 1944 than did Georgi Zhukov in 1941. Defeat in the Battle of France is in part attributed to the blinkered and tired generalship of Generals Maurice Gamelin, Alphonse Joseph Georges, and Maxime Weygand. Yet they were mere tesserae of a larger French mosaic of poor morale, social discord, and collective pre-war weariness. The notable French battle generals of World War II instead emerged later, such as the vigorous generals Henri Giraud, Jacques-Philippe Leclerc, and Jean de Lattre de Trassigny. But only when working in tandem with the British and Americans, and provided with plentiful equipment to help a winning cause reclaim their homeland. In other words, there was neither a master template for generalship across time and space, nor any certainty that battlefield genius could trump the larger landscape of the war. We are left with a banality of a golden mean between youth and experience, education and pragmatism, knowledge and natural brilliance, and audacity and circumspection, along with a caveat that, other factors being roughly equal, a genius always beats a fool, and a captain with lots of money, weapons, manpower, and supplies at his back more often wins. Perhaps the only constant in assessing great generalship is the rare ability occasionally to win battles despite the odds. In World War II, such savior generals were uncommon, with exceptions of the best like Hugh Dowding, George Patton, Erwin Rommel, William Slim, Raymond Spruance, Erich von Manstein, and Georgi Zhukov. More often, the American First Army was successful despite General Hodges, in the inverse way that no Italian general could have reached Alexandria, and even Erich von Manstein on his best day may have had no real chance to save Field Marshal Friedrich Paulus's trapped army at Stalingrad. Without General Curtis LeMay, the B-29 program might have floundered for additional months. Without the B-29, even LeMay could not have bombed Japan until July 1945. Erich von Manstein is ranked as the most brilliant of Hitler's generals, yet his career in World War II serves as an illustration of both the genius and limitations of German generalship, and he serves as a model of why Germany's technocratic generals scored early tactical victories and yet found themselves so often in a strategic blind alley. Manstein's revisionary plan, with input from Heinz Guderian, to invade France in 1940 through the Ardennes, turned a probable eventual German victory into a swift Gallic catastrophe. His madcap panzer drive to Leningrad reflected the realization that the war had to be won in months. Yet Manstein's most impressive victory was the so-called Third Battle of Kharkov, February 19th through March 15th, 1943, when after the disaster at Stalingrad in early 1943, Manstein, against all odds, cut apart a reckless Soviet pursuit, trapped over 50 Russian divisions, retook Kharkov, and bought 6 months' respite for soon-to-be vastly outnumbered forces on the Russian front. Only a handful of World War II generals could have matched such a feat. Manstein proved absolutely unshakable when threatened with a general collapse, and saw how careful defense could wound the Red Army far more than had even Blitzkrieg. Yet otherwise, Hitler's best general did not make all that much of a difference after the border wars ended in 1940, aside from his post-Stalingrad rebound. He eventually was part of the failed effort to salvage a draw at Stalingrad and win the Caucasus. Manstein captured Sevastopol in an operationally brilliant but costly and strategically negligible campaign, and never seemed to appreciate how the time and costs of taking Sevastopol affected Case Blue. He did not conduct well the admittedly hopeless effort to free the trapped at Stalingrad, either administratively or operationally. Despite his often wise cautionary warnings, Manstein was nonetheless one of the driving forces behind the ultimately wrong-headed battle at Kursk, a needless head-on crash on the part of the outnumbered underdog, akin to General Robert E. Lee's ordering of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg, or the blunt French final effort at Waterloo. For all his later denials and his military professionalism, Manstein nevertheless did nothing to object to the Nazification of the Wehrmacht, and ended up being its willing agent. Despite his written apologies, he had no insight on how to win over occupied peoples, or even to deal with Hitler's insanities other than following standard Nazi Party directives. He was emblematic of the entire German contradiction of tactical brilliance for the sake of tactical brilliance, without moral compunction or strategic discernment. Consequently, problems arise when evaluating even Germany's best generals, well aside from the divide between strategists to the rear and field marshals at the front. Germany fought two diverse wars between 1939 and 1945. The first one, dauntingly successful between 1939 and 1942, was waged against mostly weaker contiguous or nearby weaker countries, Belgium, Denmark, Greece, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Norway, Yugoslavia, and, to a different degree, France. Most of these defeated nearby nations either were surprised or lacked material parity, and usually both. Their fate seemed doomed by the collective skills of staff planners like General Franz Halder and General Walter von Brautich, professional army group leaders such as Generals Gerd von Rundstedt, Fedor von Bock, Wilhelm Ritter von Lieb, and Günther von Kluge, and practitioners of Blitzkrieg in the days before Stalingrad, such as Generals Heinz Guderian, Erwin Rommel, and Erich von Manstein. Soon, however, the Wehrmacht simultaneously battled American, British, and Russian armies, in addition to Allied air and naval power, usually without surprise or technological and material superiority, and often far beyond its own borders, facing odds quite different from the glory days of 1939 through 1942. The elite of the German officer corps was nearly wiped out between 1943 and 1945. By war's end, about 136 German generals who served as commanders of divisions, corps, and armies, rank of or above Generalmajor, had been killed in action, committed suicide, or were missing, a figure that does not include deaths from natural causes, incapacity due to illness, or forced retirement on Hitler's orders. Assessing the German generals is made most difficult by the omnipotent presence of Hitler and his National Socialist operatives. By 1940, true independence of thought was mostly impossible for German generals. Hitler eventually relieved most who dissented from his often bizarre orders. All German officers fought for a cause that ultimately furthered the enslavement of once free nations and for the final solution, however much they claimed, usually falsely, not to know at least the outlines of the Holocaust. The fact that a general eventually espoused anti-Nazi views, albeit usually either privately, in extremis or in captivity, as did the sympathetic Ludwig Beck, the occasionally principled Johannes Blaskowitz and Gotthard Henrici, and the more opportunistic Günther von Kluge, Ritter von Thoma, and Erwin von Witzleben, or in contrast was obsequiously pro-National Socialist, such as Sepp Dietrich, Walter Model, or Ferdinand Schröner, cannot but influence our judgment of his military abilities. Aside from his strategic or tactical brilliance, a Wehrmacht general was confronted with two unique challenges. First, that he might have to risk his life or career to dissent from OKH and instead follow what he thought was a winning military strategy. And second, his success meant the advance of Nazism's uniquely homicidal agendas that had nothing to do with the art of war. Given these constraints, the resurrected German general staff and Prussian military aristocracy produced perhaps the war's largest group of tactically and operationally competent army generals. It is hard to find among senior German field commanders many abject mediocrities like Friedrich Paulus, or many who were as undistinguished as British General Arthur Percival or Bernard Freiberg, or American Lieutenant General Lloyd Friedenhall or Major General John P. Lucas, or a theater commander as unimpressive as General Mark Clark, or perhaps even the iconic General Omar Bradley. But while the sheer number of highly gifted German army generals such as Hermann Balck, Heinz Guderian, Gotthard Henrici, Albert Kesselring, Walter Model, Erwin Rommel, Fedor von Bock, Günther von Kluge, Wilhelm von Lieb, Erich von Manstein, or Gerd von Rundstedt was unmatched by any other army, their efforts were often diminished by both their cause and superiors. Critics continue to argue whether the members of the General Staff were even more unimaginative than Hitler was strategically imbecilic, or were simply Prussian yes-men whose independence was mostly the stuff of diary entries and post-war mythologizing. Other than Blitzkrieg, the mastery of large-scale motorized encirclements and the use of combined operations on offense and defense, there were few lasting strategic insights achieved by German generalship. After the fall of France in July 1940, the General Staff had no grand strategies for consolidating its victories and ending the war through the absolute defeat of Germany's enemies. Although the German army had pioneered airborne operations, it proved not as adept in large airdrops as the British or Americans. The same was true of amphibious assaults. Few German commanders had as good operational intelligence as his British or American counterpart. Nor did the German logistics corps approach the sorts of supply genius displayed by the Western Allies during and after the Normandy landings. Anglo-American tactical evolution during the Battle of the Atlantic was more impressive than that of Admiral Karl Dönitz and his subordinates. Harebrained schemes and ossified protocols like monster tanks, colossal artillery pieces, and reliance on horse-powered divisions were not all Hitler's doing. In addition, the Wehrmacht by late 1943 was insidiously becoming a one-dimensional land force that monopolized the military talent of the Third Reich. The Luftwaffe by the end of 1942 had become marginalized as an independent striking force and soon was devoting well over half its resources to the defense of the fatherland from Anglo-American bombing. At the same time, the U-boat and surface fleets were increasingly rendered irrelevant. Luftwaffe commander Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring was not a leader comparable to Hap Arnold, Hugh Dowding, Curtis LeMay, Charles Portal, Carl Spatz, Arthur Tedder, or Arthur Bomber Harris. Neither Admirals Dönitz nor Erich Raeder was in the same league as either a planner or fleet admiral as their Anglo-American counterparts such as Andrew Cunningham, William Halsey, Ernest King, William Leahy, Chester Nimitz, Bertrand Ramsey, or Raymond Spruance. German military genius was so often expressed in either brilliant defense that could lead to no lasting strategic advantage, or an inspired offensive that lacked the sustained logistical wherewithal and strategic insight to win the war. Hitler's Feuerwehrmann, fireman, the diehard Nazi Walter Model, devised a clever way to draw in and cut apart advancing Soviet armies after 1941. Yet his mission was to prolong, not to win the war, and he did so in excellent fashion at a series of battles on both fronts, before Moscow and at Rzeszów, Arnhem, and especially in the Hürtgen Forest. Model largely served Hitler's dictates and ended up shooting himself on April 21, 1945, surrounded in the Ruhr and aware that the end of Nazi rule was near. Rommel is often praised as a great tactical army group leader, but rightly faulted as naive about grand strategy and logistics, given his unsupported thrusts on two occasions into Egypt. Yet perhaps he was the most impressive of the German field marshals, even if he more often operated in smaller theaters and never fought in the meat grinder of the Eastern Front. Rommel understood Blitzkrieg as a psychological tool of combined arms to collapse enemy morale through mobility and surprise, rather than the force of manpower and material per se. He did not have sufficient men or equipment to push Montgomery out of El Alamein. But the alternative to his desperate gamble to race through the British lines to capture Alexandria and reach Suez was slow strangulation, as the German and Italian supplies waned in direct proportion to the vast monthly increases in American and British convoys. By February 1943, an exasperated and often sick Rommel wrote to his wife in despair, "If only we could win a major victory here. I rack my brains night and day to find a way. Unfortunately, the conditions for it don't exist. Everything depends on supplies, and has done for years." In the great 1944 Wehrmacht debate over how to resist the Allied invasion of France, whether to fight in strength immediately near the beaches or to bank a central panzer strategic reserve to the rear, Rommel, a seasoned architect of mobile panzer tactics, was proved right that overwhelming Allied air power made obsolete the more reliable and time-tested strategy of a central panzer reserve. Better to gamble losing it in fixed battle on the shore than to have armored divisions pruned away miles from the front and hand the Allies a beachhead that would lead to a victory in the Battle of Logistics. In sum, in a Reich with an irrational leader, murderous ideology, and toadyish general staff, Rommel sought to find a way to win when there was no way to win, and more often than not kept some of his professionalism in the process. The once pro-Nazi Rommel lost his life plotting against Hitler, in a way the Pomeranian and Polish estate owners Manstein and Guderian, the two German blitzkrieg generals who were in his class, chose not to. Despite Hitler's wild strategic fantasies and erratic supreme command, German officers and soldiers were able to exact devastating losses in all three major Allied armies, inflicting casualties on British and American troops at a higher rate than the losses they incurred, and on the Eastern Front exacting over three times as many Russian fatalities for each German fatality incurred. Whether early or late in the war, on the defensive or offensive, either enjoying numerical superiority or outnumbered, the German army consistently killed more of the enemy than the enemy killed Germans. Such superiority often came despite Hitler's strategic lapses, and often without technological and air superiority, and can be attributed mostly to the operational excellence of German training, high morale, and competent officers. Of the other two Axis powers, the Italian general staff and field generals were the most inexperienced and incompetent. The career of General Marshal Rodolfo Graziani, commander-in-chief of the Italian general staff, is emblematic. Graziani rose to prominence in the Italian army in the 1920s and 1930s, in the way most generals did, by unwavering allegiance to Mussolini and through brutal conquest and occupation of Italy's East and North African colonies. When faced with modern enemies at the outbreak of World War II, such as the undermanned and ill-equipped British Western Desert Force of late 1940, Graziani illustrated the contradictions of Italian command. The dearth of mechanization and the feeble logistics meant that the army could not operate as a modern fighting force, and yet the dependence of commanders on the political patronage of Mussolini ensured that they must not only fight the British and later the Americans, but also mount poorly prepared offensives in which there was the likelihood of obliteration rather than mere defeat. When Graziani could no longer use his backward forces to slaughter mostly unorganized and poorly armed Ethiopians and Libyans, he stalled, hoped for a draw against the British in September 1940, and counted on his fascist credentials for a reprieve from Mussolini and an ultimate bailout from the Germans. The few competent Italian generals such as Giovanni Messe and the fascist firebrand Italo Balbo were either underused or killed early on. Even had either of them grew into an Italian Rommel or Patton, the dearth of fuel, adequate munitions, and logistics would have nullified their genius. To the extent that Italy's generals were prepared to fight a modern army, it was to be a supposedly isolated and ill-supplied and small British expeditionary force in Africa, not against Greeks, much less later the well-equipped Red Army and British and American soldiers in Africa, Sicily, and southern Russia. Japan offers the contrast of far more experienced and capable commanders, backed by larger and more effective forces, yet sharing the same strategic blindness and thus the same destruction at the hands of the Allies. The iconic Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto illustrates best the mythologies and realities of Japanese imperial military leadership. A trust in military fanaticism and operational excellence without proper consideration of the material means necessary to achieve strategic ends. He deservedly was credited with building up Japanese naval forces before the war, especially its key carrier arm of more than 500 superb naval pilots. He rightly opposed costly investment in iconic but otherwise anachronistic super battleships, yet it is hard to find evidence that Yamamoto or his fellow admirals displayed much strategic insight before Pearl Harbor or once the war broke out. The Japanese-Soviet Neutrality Pact, signed April 13, 1941, welcomed by Yamamoto, had ensured that Japan would never closely coordinate with its German partner any possible joint attack on two fronts against the Soviet Union, and thus turned Japanese attention to naval warfare in the Pacific, and against America in particular, with disastrous results. Yamamoto is often seen today as a Hamlet-like tragic figure, self-critical, stoic, and accepting that even his inspired tactical victories would not lead to ultimate strategic advantage, but instead to a Japanese apocalypse. Yet he was mostly responsible for the reckless decision to attack Pearl Harbor that is, arguably, along with Operation Barbarossa, one of the two most foolish operations of the war. For all its operational daring of reaching Pearl Harbor undetected in midwinter, the surprise attack was poorly conceived and not carried out well by the incompetent Admiral Chuichi Nagumo. The Japanese fleet ignored the real possibility that carriers might be missing, that the old battleships were being supplemented by more modern and superior versions in short order, that in such shallow waters it was difficult to either sink and permanently destroy ships at dock or to ensure that their trained crews were drowned, and that critical fuel supplies and dockworks needed for a reconstituted American fleet had to be part of the pre-attack planning. How exactly Yamamoto envisioned the submerging of a few old battleships as part of a strategic blueprint for neutralizing America's war effort remains a mystery. Of all the Japanese admirals, the English-speaking Yamamoto supposedly knew the most about the nature of their American enemies, and at least feared them more than he admired Japan's newfound German and Italian allies. Yet he usually drew wrong conclusions from his past residence in America, or waffled by supposed warnings of the consequences of waking the sleeping American giant at the same time that he ignored his own premonitions and rabidly lobbied for the attack. As in the case of diplomat Yosuke Matsuoka or even General Tadamichi Kuribayashi, those Japanese leaders with the most first-hand knowledge of and experience in America were sometimes those most likely to embrace flawed ideas of American frivolity and inability to take casualties. Perhaps their prior youthful experience with American racism clouded their empirical military assessments. Yamamoto and his admirals also insisted on attacking the Philippines in addition to Pearl Harbor, although some in the Japanese army had advised picking off orphan European colonies while sidestepping these American bases in hopes of preventing an all-out war with the United States. Yamamoto foolishly split up Japanese forces at the Battle of Midway. His complex plans to destroy the American fleet, in retrospect, seem crackpot. He needlessly allowed the Americans near parity in carrier forces at the battle's focus point off Midway Island. After the earlier draw at the Coral Sea, Yamamoto's admirals paused and did not exploit the near victory. Had Yamamoto instead ordered that the carrier Shokaku be immediately repaired and replacement crews raced to staff the depleted air wings of the Zuikaku during the same time period that the more crippled Yorktown was refitted, the Japanese might have fought with six rather than four carriers at Midway, even after the foolhardy diversions of carrier strength to the illusions. Admiral Yamamoto, who displayed a level of humanity foreign to many of Japan's admirals and generals, may have been the most overrated commander of World War II. His tragedy was that had he survived the successful American assassination attack on his plane, his leadership would have made absolutely no difference in the ultimate outcome of the war that he had both warned against and insisted upon. Complexity in operations, surprise, stubborn defense, and fanaticism in a global war were no substitute for inspired grand strategy and sustained military production. Most Japanese admirals reflected these institutionalized paradoxes. They professed a commitment to bold, aggressive action befitting their martial mentalities, but often proved hesitant in battle, given that they were cognizant that they lacked the industrial base to make up heavy losses in carriers and other capital ships. In other words, they grew too attached to their ships in fears of losing them. Admiral Gunichi Mikawa, after inflicting one of the worst defeats on the United States Navy in its history on the night of August 8th and 9th, 1942, at the Battle of Savo Island, abruptly withdrew his victorious forces rather than finish off the crippled American fleet. In the same manner, had Admiral Takeo Kurita not given in to his fears and backed out of his successful attack off Samar during the Battle of Leyte Gulf, he might well have destroyed far more enemy ships, perhaps even interfering with or stopping the American landings at Leyte. Japanese generals such as Tomoyuki Yamashita, the victor of Singapore, often outfought their Allied counterparts without enjoying material superiority. In early 1942, his worn-out army of 30,000 marched down the Malay Peninsula and forced Lieutenant General Percival to surrender Singapore's 120,000 British Imperial troops. Yamashita's later dogged defense of the Philippines against General Douglas MacArthur was doomed by disparities in resources, but nonetheless cost the Americans and their Filipino allies a terrible price in blood and treasure. 80,000 American casualties and an untold number of Filipinos, and raised fundamental questions about why the island archipelago was not bypassed for a more direct route to Japan, perhaps through Formosa. Masaharu Homma, likewise executed for war crimes at war's end, conquered most of the Philippines in 1942, but without the full support of his superiors. Mitsuru Ushijima shocked the United States on Okinawa, mastering the tactics of Japanese island defense and turning what was expected to be a relatively rapid and certain victory into the worst American ground experience of the Pacific War. Confined to fighting mostly on the defense in rough terrain, occasional jungles, and on islands, Japanese generals, the brilliant and multi-talented defender of Iwo Jima, Tadamichi Kuribayashi, was perhaps the best example, inflicted severe losses on their often more numerous and better supplied Anglo-American enemies. The absence of large open expanses in the Pacific, where mobile artillery, tanks, and late-model fighter bombers were critical for advancement, favored the tactics of Japanese entrenched resistance, as did Japanese militarist doctrines that precluded either surrender en masse or arranged armistices. In sum, Japanese commanders had originally assumed the Western Allies' two-front war with Germany would mean fewer Anglo-American resources devoted to the Pacific. They failed to realize that marines, carriers, and naval aircraft were not so sorely needed in Europe, and that a belligerent like the United States, with twice the manpower and well over five times Japan's industrial capacity, could easily fight a two-front war that nearly bankrupted Japan. Japanese naval commanders were pioneers in carrier operations, and yet had no plan for the mass training of replacement naval aviators, much less matching American carrier production and fighter output. For all Japan's impressive industrialization, too often its military defined martial courage in medieval terms, largely as face-of-battle prowess, whereas their enemies took a more holistic view of lethality through the marriage of man with machine. Lots of good pilots in the Hellcats were far more deadly than a few excellent pilots in Zeros. The 1st Marine Division or the 7th Army Division, eventually to be backed by limitless supplies and coupled with air and naval superiority, were man for man far more deadly than the most seasoned Japanese infantry after years of combat in China. The leadership was to blame for these misconceptions. After wrongly assuming that the surprised Americans would eventually sue for terms after December 7, 1941, the generals and admirals compounded their error by concluding that the Allies would not expend the necessary blood and treasure required to force an unconditional surrender on Japan. Japanese commanders had no margin of error in World War II, and rather than making up for material disadvantages, only compounded them. No belligerent on either side suffered more lost generals than did the Soviet Union. Over 150 generals were killed in action, often caught in the huge encirclements of 1941 and 1942. Still another 50 of various rank may have been executed by the Soviet High Command during the rapid German advance in the first 6 months of the war, and especially after the fall of Kiev and the battle for Moscow. A few were shot on Stalin's orders on the eve of the war as part of the final purges of Soviet officers, and a small number, among them the well-known Andrei Vlasov, for a time joined the German effort as part of the Russian Liberation Army, ROA, and various volunteer groups or Hilfswillige units integrated into the Wehrmacht. Almost all anti-Soviet generals were either killed in battle or executed after the war. Included in the death toll were not just obscure commanders, but some of the finest generals of the pre-war Soviet army, such as those who were killed early in the war, like Generals V.V. Borisov, N.A. Dedeyev, P.M. Filatov, and Mikhail Kirponos. Yet amid the wreckage of Soviet generalship, from prior purges, executions, and the dark days of summer 1941, emerged some of the most brilliant commanders of the entire war, especially the famous triad of Ivan Konev, Konstantin Rokossovsky, and the iconic Georgi Zhukov. The criticism of Russian military leadership during World War II was that it sought to bury the Wehrmacht through largely frontal artillery-backed assaults on a broad front, on the theory that Germany would run out of reserves and supplies before the Soviet Union, and that the United States and Britain would bleed Germany from the air and in the Western and Mediterranean theaters far more than Japan and the Italians would erode the Americans and British. The reason that the Russians could endure such untold numbers of casualties and not suffer a general collapse in the face of the German juggernaut was precisely because the Red Army insidiously became a sophisticated, mechanized, and mobile force. The Soviet Union had embraced the tactics of mechanized warfare in the 1930s and undertaken substantial tank production. It was the recipient of hundreds of thousands of American trucks and jeeps and focused on tactical air support of ground forces. German generals often reported that the Red Army predictably assembled massive artillery and rocket batteries, blasted enemy lines, sent in its superb T-34 tanks accompanied by hundreds of thousands of well-trained troops, disregarded casualties, and waited to exploit tears and gaps in German lines. That generalization is not wrong so much as incomplete, given that the Soviets refined maskirovka, an institutionalized art of deception and misinformation that sought to fool German armies as to the size and intent of their Soviet counterpart, and which helps to explain why seasoned German veterans were so often surprised. Some of the greatest encirclements and inspired generalship of the war, especially when the Red Army was on the defensive and felt to be on the verge of defeat or collapse, were the work of Soviet generals. The transfer of 18 divisions from the Far East, which led to the creation of a critical 52-division reserve by Generals Zhukov and Alexander Vasilevsky, surprised and stopped the Germans on the outskirts of Moscow. Operation Uranus, November 19th through the 23rd, 1942, the complete encirclement and destruction at Stalingrad of the German 6th Army, the 3rd and 4th Romanian Armies, as well as large parts of the German 4th Panzer Army, was also planned by General Zhukov and Vasilevsky. The various Soviet defenses of Sevastopol, organized by General Petrov, stymied General Manstein off and on for over 6 months and helped foul the timetable of the Case Blue 1942 offensive to the Caucasus. Generals Ivan Konev, Konstantin Rokossovsky, the brilliant Nikolai Vatutin, and Georgi Zhukov were far better prepared than their German counterparts at Kursk, with elaborate minefields, anti-tank ditches, and fortifications that made it nearly impossible before the battle had begun for German panzers to cut off the salient. For the first 2 years of the war, British generals were assigned missions in Norway, France, Greece, and North Africa without adequate supplies or manpower. In such peripheral theaters, to injure Germany required mostly air forces, while the Navy was devoted to ensuring that convoys reached Britain and entered the Mediterranean to supply the North African theater. The nightmare of World War I and the Dunkirk retreat had ensured that almost no one was eager to return sizable armies to France. Until the arrival of General Rommel in North Africa in February 1942, British generalship did not have to be especially inspired to defeat Mussolini's forces. All that said, Britain's field leadership was superb. Its forte was strategic thinking and a reliable corps of army generals such as Bernard Montgomery and William Slim, sea lords like Andrew Cunningham, Bertram Ramsay, and James Somerville, and air marshals such as Hugh Dowding, Charles Portal, and Arthur Tedder. For all their occasional condescension toward the Americans, they nonetheless forged the British and later Allied strategy to win the war. First, knock out fascist Italy through a North African and eventual Sicilian campaign, while keeping the Atlantic sea lanes open and bombing Germany until the entrance of the Soviet Union or the United States into the war might provide the wealth and manpower to counter the German army on the continent. The typical complaint against British generalship, exclusively on land rather than at sea and in the air, where the British enjoyed greater comparative material resources, was over cautiousness. The British entered the war under-equipped and outmanned by the Axis, and essentially lost the Army's material and cohesion at Dunkirk, shocks that continued to affect British command well after the material advantages were with the Allies. There are numerous examples of when more audacious British generalship might have stopped German advances and shortened the war. General Neil Ritchie's confused response to an advancing Rommel during May through June 1942 that led to the fall of Tobruk, General Bernard Montgomery's reluctance to pursue the enemy in haste after the victory at El Alamein, or to take greater risks to break out in June 1944 in Normandy, or to close the Falaise pocket, or to secure the approaches to Antwerp, and the lack of urgency on the part of the otherwise solid General Brian Horrocks during the Market Garden campaign. Good leadership could have stopped, at least for a few additional months, the outnumbered Japanese attackers at Singapore. General Freiberg was hesitant and did not fight well on Crete. The island's British defenses also drew on thousands of Greek volunteers who might easily have held out against airborne assault. After autumn 1942, there were few British blunders. The insistence on a convoy system in the Atlantic, the destruction of the French fleet at Mers el-Kébir in Algeria, the initial preference for night rather than day strategic bombing in the days before fighter escort, the postponement of a second front in 1942 and 1943, and the idea of invading North Africa and Sicily were all sound. If the task of the British military leadership was to craft and follow a strategy to avoid crippling army losses, to bomb Germany without prematurely meeting the main forces of the Wehrmacht on land, to knock Mussolini out of the war early on, to keep resistance to the Axis alive until the arrival of either the United States or the USSR, to secure Suez and Gibraltar, to save Burma, and to keep India safe, then it succeeded magnificently. Another achievement of the British military leadership was to exercise a near-equal strategic and operational voice with its American and Soviet allies, despite a growing inferiority in men and war material as it fought two concurrent wars with less than half the fatalities incurred in World War I. In part, such influence was due to unmatched British technological know-how, from its preeminence with the so-called ultra-intercepts to mastery of sonar and radar. In addition, the British learned from over 2 years longer experience than the Americans in fighting the Wehrmacht, and earned moral stature by alone keeping resistance to the Third Reich alive before June 1941. If British generals sometimes seemed too conservative to both their Russian and American counterparts, they were usually right when they advised what not to do, and thereby provided a critical sobriety to the Allied cause. And if generals like Montgomery seemed arrogant in a petty way, it was perhaps because they believed, rightly, that the relative small size of the British Army, in comparison to the Russian and American, was not an accurate illustration of Britain's overall contribution to the Allied war effort. If a disproportionately high number of German officers arose out of the 19th century Prussian Junker aristocracy, the nurseries of American World War II generals and admirals were largely the middle classes of the suburbs, small towns, and farms, often disproportionately from the American Midwest, South, and rural coastlands, places like Perry, Georgia, Courtney Hodges, Abilene, Kansas, Dwight D. Eisenhower, Clark, Missouri, Omar Bradley, Lorain, Ohio, Ernest King, Boyertown, Pennsylvania, Carl Spatz, Uniontown, Pennsylvania, George Marshall, Chatfield, Texas, Lucien Truscott, Field Creek, Texas, Ira Eaker, and Fredericksburg, Texas, Chester Nimitz. Still, there was a fault line among American flag officers. On the one hand, there were most famously the quintessential American organizers and conciliators, perhaps emblemized by Generals Bradley, Eisenhower, Hodges, and Marshall, or Admirals Nimitz and Spruance. All were thoroughly professional, both in temperament and behavior, who reflected the strengths of American common sense in their sober and workmanlike decisions. They rarely made mistakes and in steady fashion maximized the material advantages that soon accrued to their forces. At the other pole, however, were a minority of maverick firebrands at different levels of command. King, Halsey, LeMay, Patton, some with checkered personal lives, some with flamboyant personas and blunt and often salty language, for example, the aphorism attributed to Admiral King, when they get in trouble, they send for the sons of bitches. These latter classical archetypes sought to suffuse their swashbuckling personalities among their soldiers as if they could turn GI conscripts into professionals akin to Alexander the Great's companions, Caesar's 10th Legion, or Napoleon's Old Guard, who might match and trump even the Elan of the Waffen-SS or the Japanese veterans of a decade's fighting in China. They believed that by sheer force of willpower, American soldiers and sailors could defeat Axis forces without waiting for absolute naval, air, or material superiority. The Supreme Warlords Hap Arnold, Ernest King, William Leahy, and George Marshall shared an uncanny genius for recognizing military need and then raising and allotting the required resources to various theaters. Leahy, perhaps the most underappreciated but important of the four, proved to be Roosevelt's eyes and ears and successfully balanced competing claims from the respective land, air, and sea interests. He was the most trusted by the British, though perhaps because he most enjoyed the confidence and intimacy of Roosevelt. It was also to the credit of King and Arnold that they did not see the headline-grabbing virtuoso commanders, Patton, MacArthur, Halsey, and LeMay, as threats to be sidetracked, but as assets to be supported and promoted. The laundry list of American strategic and operational lapses is long and includes technological, operational, tactical, and strategic misconceptions. Not initially escorting convoys, fantasizing about opening a front in France in 1942 and 1943, persisting in unescorted daylight precision bombing over Europe, believing that tank destroyers obviated the need for a heavier battle tank, the assumptions of radically reducing Japanese island concrete bunkers through preliminary naval shelling and aerial bombing, inertia at Salerno and Anzio, not better coordinating the MacArthur and Nimitz parallel strategies in the Pacific, a focus on taking Rome rather than encircling German forces in Italy, the dispersion of forces through a landing in southern France, shorting naval bombardment at Normandy, surprise about the hedgerows behind Omaha Beach, greenlighting Operation Market Garden, General Bradley's failure to use experience from the Pacific Theater, Bush League, to refine amphibious operations at Normandy, the ambiguous and lackadaisical attitude about Patton's unexpected rapid advance eastward across France in August 1944, logistical collapse in eastern France in September 1944, the piecemeal method of replacing infantry losses, entry into and head-on slogging in the Hürtgen Forest, surprise before the Battle of the Bulge, and a later unwillingness to cut the German salient off at its base, tactical predictability on Okinawa, and the inability to relieve or demote quickly generals in way over their heads, such as John Lucas, Lloyd Friedendahl, and Leslie McNair. American commanders were indoctrinated in two tactical traditions. One was made famous by Ulysses S. Grant and later John J. Pershing, emphasizing finding the enemy, then confronting and destroying him through overwhelming firepower. However, even by 1944, American soldiers did not always possess either overwhelming firepower, superior machine guns, tanks, anti-tank weaponry, or the battle experience to smash through German entrenched forces, whether in the Bocage beyond Omaha Beach, in the Hürtgen Forest, or against urban strongholds such as Metz. Attempts to do so could prove bloody and counterproductive. There was also a complementary tradition of mobility, envelopment, and stripping an enemy's ability to make war by destroying his infrastructure and morale. It could be argued that General William T. Sherman's great marches through Georgia and the Carolinas in 1864 and 1865 had equally collapsed Southern morale in concert with Grant's head-on advances in the summer and fall of 1864. By April 1865, Sherman's huge mobile army had disrupted Confederate supply and communications, cost few Union lives, and helped to force General Robert E. Lee's surrender by the specter of an unconquered Army of the West approaching through the Carolinas. General Patton, for most of his career, was more emblematic of that second tradition, which its proselytizer, the British military analyst B.H. Little Hart, had canonized as the indirect approach. Had the U.S. Army fully utilized its singular motorized mobility and tactical air power in the manner that Patton's Third Army had used them to cover its flanks, and then adopted a similar Sherman-esque attitude toward bypassing more resistance and conducting encirclements, the war in theory might well have ended before 1945. Eventually, the American Joint Chiefs got most of the critical strategic decisions right, especially when the huge productive capacity of the United States at last kicked in by 1943 and made possible all the grandiose schemes of simultaneously zeroing in on Berlin and Tokyo. The High Command would insist that America was to defeat Germany first through an eventual landing on the continent. Carriers and island hopping would spearhead the American effort to cut off the Japanese homeland from its empire and render it defenseless to invasion. Massive aid would be given to both Britain and the Soviet Union. The Joint Chiefs would support the megalomaniac and politically untouchable Douglas MacArthur, who had at times possessed a natural talent of creating armies and knowing where to deploy them, without turning over too many strategic decisions to his often unsteady judgment. No general more often was surprised and surprised others than MacArthur. He also had a unique talent for deploring the precise strategic and operational lapses in others that were characteristic of his own command. He could lament the Navy's wastage from Tarawa to Okinawa without acknowledging his own questionable insistence on slogging it out at the costly battles for Peleliu and the Philippines. MacArthur was not relieved or even reprimanded for being both forewarned and surprised in the Philippines in the early morning of December 8, 1941. Consequently, it still seems strange that Admiral Husband E. Kimmel and Lieutenant General Walter C. Short, along with the Army Air Force Commander at Pearl Harbor, Major General Frederick Martin, were all sacked for being caught off guard on December 7th. But it was ultimately fortuitous, given the post-Pearl Harbor ascendance of admirals like King and Nimitz. Another area where the Americans outshone all other land forces was their astonishing number of brilliant division, corps, and army commanders deployed in Europe, mostly 1-, 2-, and 3-star generals who were more talented than the 4-star generals such as Bradley, Clark, and Hodges who commanded them. There were no finer division or corps commanders than Terry Mesa Allen, J. Lawton Collins, Manton S. Eddy, Leonard T. Giroux, Wade Hayslip, Troy Middleton, Matthew Ridgway, Lucien Truscott, and Walton Walker. The general excellence of the Army's infantry and armor commanders was partly due to the combat experience of many in World War I, partly to the excellent system of war colleges and continuing tactical and strategic education, especially at the Command and General Staff School at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas during the 1930s, and partly to the sheer winnowing-out process of the Depression-era Army that created motivation and competition for scarce resources and rare promotions. It was the ultimate contradiction of World War II that the Axis military regimes that had bragged of their greater military expertise fielded the less capable supreme leaders, strategists, and warlords. Instead of military men narrowing the odds against their larger and more materially rich enemies, German, Italian, and Japanese generals and admirals often widened them. The next chapters emphasize how the rank and file back home played as critical a role in the war as did their officers and fighting men and women. The Allies initially enjoyed access to far greater natural wealth, especially oil, iron ore, food, and strategic metals, than did the Axis powers. But such natural bounty did not automatically equate to greater material advantages in war, especially in the case of Britain, which was bombed, and the Soviet Union, which was invaded. Instead, Allied planners and industrialists proved more savvy than their Italian, Japanese, and German counterparts in exploiting their natural wealth as their factory workers and farmers became more efficient producers. The resulting plethora of supplies gave the Allies untold material advantages, particularly in compensating for both frequent deficiencies in the quality of their arms and the occasional operational shortcomings of their generals and strategists. By early 1942, the Axis powers had occupied a geographical expanse equal to that of the Allied homelands, a greater Third Reich together with the greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere and its adjacent landscapes under Japanese control that stretched from the English Channel to the Mongolian border, albeit with the British blocking free transit through the Mediterranean. Add in Mussolini's African and Balkan territories, and a global map of World War II in mid-1942 reveals a sea of Axis-controlled land. But whereas Americans, British, and Russians worked fervently to win the war for the idea of their very survival, those under Axis occupation were never eager to fuel foreign fascist agendas, even had their overseers been competent in organizing them to work productively. Germany was acknowledged as a pre-war industrial powerhouse, whereas the Soviet Union was written off as an assumed collective and totalitarian failure. Yet as the war progressed, the Russians turned out far more weapons than did Germany, often with help from the British Empire and the United States, and made even greater sacrifices to do so than did the supposedly fanatic adherents of National Socialism. In sum, if millions of workers under Axis occupation were far less productive than the often bombed and invaded laborers in Britain and the Soviet Union, the American military economy remained in a special category all by itself, safe from attack and organized by industrial geniuses never seen before, or perhaps since. 18. The Workers. World War II was won by the greater natural wealth, production, and capital of the Allies. Yet these advantages were not foreordained. Three themes characterize the growing material edge of the Allies over the Axis powers. First, Allied workers were less often guest or coerced workers, but labored willingly with national resolve. Second, the Allies enjoyed greater naval and air power that allowed them to tap into global resources and transport them to the front lines from areas in Asia, Africa, and the Americas that were often untouched by war. Third, by early 1943, almost all American, British, and Russian factories, transportation, and fields were beyond the reach of German panzers and bombers, even as Allied air power, soon to be augmented by ground forces, began pounding Axis production. After September 1939, perhaps 1 billion of the world's roughly 2 billion population were soldiers, partisans, and producers engaged in trying to kill people. Victory hinged on whether the Axis or the Allies would continually put on the field of battle the most soldiers with the most plentiful weapons and sustenance, to a point where the relative quality of generals, soldiers, and arms became somewhat secondary. When the global war commenced in full in late 1941, the majority of the world's population was either neutral or on the Allied side. Great Britain and its active dominions, the United States and the Soviet Union, possessed a combined population of over 400 million persons, more than double the manpower available to the three major Axis powers, without consideration of the huge populations of an allied China or a British-held India. The